book of Deuteronomy, and again chapter 33. Deuteronomy and chapter 33. And we'll confine our reading to the concluding part of the chapter tonight, commencing at verse 26. Perhaps I should read verse 1 just to give the context. And this is the blessing wherewith Moses, the man of God, blessed the children of Israel before his death. And he said, verse 26, there is none like unto the God of Jeshurun, who rideth upon the heaven in thy help, and in his excellency on the sky. The eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. And he shall thrust out the enemy from before thee, and shall say, destroy them. Israel then shall dwell in safety alone. The fountain of Jacob shall be upon a land of corn and wine. Also his heavens shall drop down dew. Happy art thou, O Israel, who is like unto thee, O people saved by the Lord, the shield of thy help, and who is the sword of thy excellency. And thine enemies shall be found liars unto thee, and thou shalt tread upon their high places. And that will be our reading tonight, an interesting and brief reading from the Word of God. I think we are all very well aware that the book of Deuteronomy is part of the final legacy of Moses, the man of God, the great statesman as he was, and we have a number of messages which he delivered in the closing months of his life. And by the time we have reached these concluding chapters, we are in the closing days and in the closing hours of the life of this great man. We find it very strange that in the next chapter, when it comes to his death, he is buried in an unmarked grave in a valley in Moab. And as we read the account of Moses' burial in Deuteronomy chapter 34, the thought crosses our minds that it could have been all so different. It could have been a pyramid in Egypt. It could have been an impressive obelisk in the land of the Pharaoh. But instead of that, it is the unknown grave. This man had made a choice. The choice had changed the course of his life. And when you think of what it could have been, and when you think over against that of what it was, you begin to ask yourself, I wonder, was it a wise choice? Well, if you have any doubts about his wisdom, I think you should just wait until you meet him and ask him, did he have any regrets in the choice that he made? And it will be a very interesting answer that he will be able to give. Now, in these concluding chapters of Deuteronomy, we have just been interested at the present time upon one chapter. But in the concluding chapters, he is making his final arrangements so that when eventually he passes off the scene, everything will be in order. For example, in chapter 31, we have Moses' successor. He tells the nation on that particular occasion, there are four mentions, if I remember, in that chapter of Joshua. He said that another man is coming on, equipped by the Spirit of God, and he will take the cloak of responsibility, and Moses' successor is appointed. He didn't appoint a son, but he appointed a spiritual man. You know, not every father has a son who can carry on responsibility amongst the Lord's people. And even the great man Moses, albeit he had a son, and of course his grandson was a disaster, and he started idolatry, but nevertheless, Moses did not appoint his family. His brother Aaron appointed under divine direction his son. Moses might have said, well, if Aaron's boy takes over from him, I make sure that my boy takes over from me. But not so. Moses was not governed by considerations of nature. He was governed by considerations of spirituality, and the spiritual man, Joshua, from a different tribe, from a different family altogether, he became Moses' successor. When we turn the page to chapter 32, we have Moses' great Saul. I haven't been able to touch it. If we had been working for another night or two, it would have been interesting just to take a look at the great song of Moses, the last piece of writing that he did. And the record with us is the 32nd chapter of Deuteronomy. What we have been interested in these few nights and few sessions of ministry is Moses' great synopsis. Because in Deuteronomy chapter 33, Moses is taking a look forward to the situation across Jordan. You see, with his natural eye, God allowed this man to see the land from the pinnacle of Pisgah. But with his prophetic eye, he not only saw the land, but he saw the people in the land. And in Deuteronomy 33, he moves from north to south, and he examines the inheritance of the tribe, and he gives us the 10 blessings that we have examined, and he sees the people in the good of their long promised inheritance and enjoying the land of milk and honey. So that it is a prophetic chapter, and he's given us a full synopsis of the whole future in these verses. And then, as I've said already, at the end of the book, there in chapter number 34, it's not his successor, and it's not his song, and it's not his synopsis of conditions in the land, but it is a sepulchre. He didn't have a house. He left a palace. When he died, he didn't even have a house. I presume he didn't handle much money, although he had handled much wealth in his time. His choice had brought tremendous change in circumstances, and yet this man has bequeathed to us the inestimable wealth of the first five books of the Bible. Wealth is relative, and it depends whether you're looking at the wealth of heaven or the wealth of earth. Your estimation will depend upon that. When it is Moses' successor, I'm thinking of this business of sight, the man's clarity of vision, it tells us beautifully there in the next chapter that his natural course wasn't abated and his eye wasn't dim. He was very, very clear in sight, not only natural sight, but clear in spiritual sight. When it was a matter of a successor in chapter 31, it was the question of oversight. Who's going to watch over the people of God? Moses said there's a man to do it. He put Joshua in the position of oversight. When it was the song of chapter 32, it was a question of insight. Because Moses knew the hearts of the people. And he could detect within them those wandering tendencies. And as he goes down that great song and speaks about some of the failures of the future, he groans from the very depths of his being. Oh, that they were wise, that they understood this, that they would consider their latter end. And he had an insight into the difficulties that would come. When we get to chapter number 33, it's foresight. Because Moses, as I've already said, with prophetic vision, is looking forward to the tribes in the land. And when you get to chapter 34, it's hindsight. And we're looking back upon a man who in that chapter is called the service of the Lord. And the Bible tells us that in all the future history of Israel, there was not a man arose just like Moses. Absolutely unique in history and also unique in Scripture. So that having made those general statements, I want to come back now to consider chapter 33. I'm going to tell you for the last time, and you'll not want to hear this until the closing days of the millennium, that there are three divisions in Deuteronomy 33. I've covered the ground because I don't just expect you to be like Irish people, but when we're in Ireland, we repeat things very often because it takes a little while in the uptake. And however, you'll bear with us. We have the prologue, the first four verses after the title in verse 1, verses 2 to 5, the prologue, verses 6 to 25, the catalogue, and verses 26 to 29, the epilogue. The prologue to blessing, the catalogue of blessings, and the epilogue of blessings. And as we have followed through the drift of this beautiful poetry, we have discovered that in the prologue, Moses gives to these people the source of blessing. In the catalogue, he expands and he explains the substance of blessing. And in the epilogue, he gives the sequel to blessing. Because the people who enjoy these blessings, they will find themselves in the situation that is described in the concluding four verses. Now, we have some interesting things to mention. It's different material altogether, and I'll do my best. We have prolonged some of the meetings, but it's a shorter section, and I'll do my best to say what I want to say and bring the meeting to a conclusion. There are four verses, as you can see, from verse 26 down to verse 29. Now, those four verses of the epilogue, they are divided into two sections. In the first two verses, the emphasis is upon the uniqueness of Israel's God. You look, for example, at verse number 26. There is none like unto the God of Jeshurun. The uniqueness of Israel's God. When you go to the last two verses, verse 28, and verse 29, the emphasis upon in those verses is upon the uniqueness of God's Israel. Look, for example, at verse 29. Happy art thou, O Israel, who is like unto thee, a people saved by the Lord. So the first two verses tells us there is no one like God. The second two verses tell us there is no one, none like God's people. The uniqueness of Israel's God and the uniqueness of God's Israel. Now, I'll take a minute or two and we'll look at those two little stanzas that make up the epilogue to this poem. Now, as far as the first one is concerned, the lines that bring it to a conclusion, these two verses, verses 26 and 27, they are divided as follows. You have one line, followed by three couplets. Now, if you have your Bible open and you're looking at them, the first line is this. There is none like unto the God of Jeshurun. That's line one. That stands on its own. That gives the theme and the text for this particular stanza. Then the next two lines, you'll see that they are very alike. Who rideth upon the heaven, and he rideth on the sky. Then the next two lines, the eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath of the everlasting arms. And thirdly, the next two lines, he shall thrust out the enemy, and shall say, destroy them. So the reason I'm taking time just to mention these things, we have covered very practical material last night, and I want to just spend the minutes a little bit more doctrinal tonight, and I want to mention that for younger believers here, if you take time to examine the poetry of the Old Testament, you will find it to be very, very interesting. It's carefully structured, it's laid out, you need to think about it, you need to apply your mind to it, but if you do, you'll find the results, the dividends, will be well worthwhile. So, the first section, the first two verses before us tonight, is just the greatness of God. As Moses thinks about all these blessings that have come, and thinks about a people in relationship with God, this is what he exclaims. He says, there's none like the God of Jeshurun. None like the God of Jeshurun. Now, I want to speak to you for just a moment a few moments about the transcendence of God. God transcends every other feature, and he transcends every other person, greater than human, greater than nation, greater than angel, greater than demon, in a category exclusively his own. There is none like the God of Jeshurun. When Moses comes to the end of this great catalogue of blessing, again, before he stops speaking, he directs the minds of the Israelites to the exclusive greatness of their God. You know, I think that's a healthy thing in our day and age. If there is any area in which our modern society has become deficient, it is almost a total loss of a conception of the greatness of God. Sometimes people talk about the man above. I know you don't speak, I'm referring to people at large. I hear people talk about the man upstairs. Now, God is not a man. Tiger Woods said there some time ago when he knocked his little white ball around and managed to get it into a hole or two. He said they were wondering how did he make. Oh, he said the big guy in the sky. The very concept, the biblical concept of God has been diminished and diluted around us. And there's always a danger that since we live in this secular and this humanistic society where there is the deification of man, and man has become the greatest, and man's brilliance, and man's brawn, and man's bigness is being worshipped, there is just the danger that something of that could creep into our own souls, and we could lose a conception of the uniqueness, the transcendence, the immensity, and the immutability of God. There is none like the God of... How many times does that occur in the Bible? If anybody knows, shout out. I'll not be a little bit annoyed about it. 7 times. You know, Pharaoh had to learn it. Moses said to Pharaoh, he said, these plagues are coming upon you, sir. He says that you might learn that there is none like God in all the earth. He said, worship cows and worship frogs and worship fish and worship the sun and worship the moon, if you like. In Egypt, they had a whole range of gods. He said, God is going to teach you that there is none like him in all the earth. You know, I believe, brethren and sisters, that God will not allow human history to conclude until he teaches men that men are men, and until he teaches the universe that God is God. May we appreciate ourselves to be but dust and ashes, the fabric of clay, with our breath in our nostrils, and may we have the reverence to appreciate the transcendent greatness of God. Solomon said it. David said it. You know, there's a lady said it. She prayed for a man child. She was concerned about the deteriorating conditions in Israel. And the old priest that was sitting there, he didn't have much spiritual discernment about the quality and the character of this particular lady. You know all about the story. But when the man child was born, Hannah burst into praise. She said, there is no God like our God. None like him. Even, dear brethren and sisters, let us again Just have confidence in this. I know situations are difficult. I know the days are dark. I know the work is very demanding. You say, but times have changed. People had it great back in the 1800s and even back in the 1940s. Things were much easier. Times have changed. Yes, to be sure, times have changed. But remember, God is still unchanged. There is none like the God of Jeshurun. You know, God is not, well, there are certain similarities between God and ourselves. It is an insult when the heathen made images of God and they had a lion or a bullock. Because God is not like a lion or a bullock. But there are certain features about us that do reflect the character of God, because God made man in his own image. So that we have intelligence and we have emotions and we have a will. And the human personality in its various components is like God. We are like God. In fact, that's the very term in the original in Psalm number 8. Thou madest him a little lower than God. In what sense then does this verse say at the conclusion, there is none like God? If there are certain features about us that reflect the image of God, in God's image and in God, sure, we are like God. No, Moses says, now listen. He says, when it comes to this great matter, he said, I wrote that back in Genesis chapter 1. He said that man was made in the likeness of God. That came from my pen. But he said, even though I wrote that, I want you to understand that in quality, there is none like God. You know, there's as much difference between the greatest man and God as there is between a raindrop and the Pacific Ocean. There's as much difference between the most intelligent man and God as there is between a snowflake and the Arctic ice cap. There's as much difference between man and God as there is between this little room and the whole of space. Can it be measured? Not bounded by matter. Not bounded by time, not bounded by space. As I say again, brethren and sisters, I'm just taking the time tonight to emphasize that once we get to the end of these blessings, if you want to find a blessed people, they are a people who have their souls filled with a worship at the greatness of God. Indeed, it amazes me, I'm speaking again about our own little corner across the water there, it amazes me how little preaching I hear. In fact, and there's a friend here tonight from our own country, and he can maybe testify the same, a brother here. I have never in my short lifetime heard a week of ministry on just nothing but the attributes of God. In fact, let me read you this. Listen to this. The proper study of the Christian is the Godhead. The highest science, you younger brethren here, listen especially to this. The highest science, the loftiest speculation, the mightiest philosophy which can engage the attention of the child of God is the name, the nature, the person, the doings, and the existence of the great God which he called his Father. It is a subject so vast that all our thoughts are lost in its immensity, and so deep that our pride is drowned in its infinity. You know who said that? C.H. Spurgeon. When he made that great statement and preached his message upon the immutability of God, He was a young man, 19 years old. And in his late teen, impressed with what it really means to be God. And it's no surprise to me that in the next 35 years he moved to England. Some of the dear young brethren here that are within the sweep of my hand there in your teen, I would say to you, spend a good deal of time in the book of God, thinking about the nature of God, enjoying the presence of God, impressed in your soul with the glory of God, until you find the vision so compelling that the rest of your life you give your very best for God. There is none like the God of Jeshurun. Of course, it is precious, and I don't want to leave this now, I'm leaving the clause now, but I just want to mention this particular title of God. Even though he's totally in a category of his own, unequal. In fact, the word that the old Puritans, that the old theologians used for this, that I'm speaking about just now, have been speaking about, is aseity. Now, you'll not just, that's just one of the antique English words, A-S-E-I-T-Y. They spoke about the aseity of God. That's a subject for you for your next ministry meeting. Now, what they meant by that was that God is absolutely independent. You know, I cannot live, and you cannot live, without drawing upon help and sustenance from outside sources. We need air to breathe. We need food to live. We need sleep. We need rest. God needs none of those things. He never eats. He doesn't depend on air. He never sleeps. He never wanes. He never wearies. Everything that God needs is supplied within the boundaries of his own vast being. He's always giving out to the millions of his creatures, angelic, animal, and human. He's always giving out. And yet out of his immensity, he never needs to take in. The independence of the everlasting God, there is none like him. The God of Jeshurun. You see, I, people say to me, maybe I was telling them, I'll pick up the road here a bit, a few months ago. And when I would come to a place like this, folks say to me, where do you live? Do you live in Ireland? And I know what they mean. But I don't live in Ireland. You say, where do you, I live here. I live here. There's none of me back in Ireland. Maybe a few of these hairs that have fallen out, but they are dead too. I live here in this square 18 inches. I live here and I can't live anywhere. I can't even live in the back room of the hall. I'm circumscribed by the dimensions of my own physicality. I would like to preach in 3 meetings every night, but I have to make do with preaching in 1. You know, I'm not the man that I was when I arrived here on Saturday morning. There have been millions of brain cells died since Saturday morning that will never be replaced. You folks, I don't be saying we noticed that. But I don't want any clever remarks. But they will never be replaced. I am about 3 days older, or a little more, and I'm becoming
a person when I arrive back home, hopefully tomorrow, I will have become 3 or 4 days older than when I am not. I can't say I am.
You know when God said to Moses, Moses said, what's your name? He says, Moses, tell them, I am that I am. You know, a million years ago, God was just the same as he is tonight. And a million years hence, he will be the same.
There is none like God.
Oh, brethren and sisters, this would send us away back to the routine of assembly meetings with fresh muscle in our spiritual limbs. This would give us fresh heart. I tell you, you people come to read the book of God. Gather to preach the gospel of God. Come together to worship the Son of God. It makes the whole thing significant because it has all to do with God. There is none. But then, of course, even though he is this great God, immutable, and in a category alone apart, wholly other, altogether other, isn't it a great mercy that he has ever taken on relationship with human beings? Now, the titles of deity, we have one of them here, the God of Jeshurun. But the titles of deity, it's a tremendously interesting study. Indeed, maybe just take a minute. In Canada, a couple of years ago, I was there, and I was speaking to our brother. He's a very good brother, speaks ministry meetings, conferences, and so on. Well-taught brother. And I was asking him how things were going on. He said, David, he said, I want to tell you, he said, we've had a very precious time in the assembly. I said, you have? What has happened? He said, about a couple of years ago, he said, we had come to the end of a particular book. I think it was Luke's Gospel or something in their Bible study. And he said, I decided that I would say to the younger brethren, what do you think we should take up? And there was a young man in the assembly, and he said to them, he said, I think I would love you to take up the attributes of God. So he said, I didn't just know how to work with this. But he says, we considered it for a week and others were favorable. And he said, eventually we decided to take it up. And he said, we made out a little program for 2 months on the attributes of God. God's love and God's power and God's mercy. And he said, we had 2 months made out on that. He said, when we got started to it, it took us 18 months. Now he says, I can't believe. He says, I can't express to you, David. He said, the meetings of the assembly, after 4 or 5 weeks, he said, the spiritual tone in the meetings of the assembly started to rise. And he said, in my 54 years, we have never had anything like it. Now he said, we might have problems coming, I don't doubt. But he said, we delved into that, and he went to his bookcase, and he brought out to me 250 pages. Closely typed material. He said, take a scan through that. I was through it for about half an hour, and I couldn't. Now he said, the impact that had on the assembly was unbelievable. He said, to be honest, I thought that younger folks would find this a bit heavy going and a bit heady and a bit theological and not practical enough. And he said, we try to have something that's to do with tell younger people where to go and all about courtship and what to wear and jump here and jump there and do this and don't do that. And he said, we like to keep it relevant and practical and on the cutting edge. And he said, I thought if you get into this, they'll drift. He said, I want to tell you, younger folks wouldn't miss a meeting. He said, they wouldn't miss a meeting. And he said, the glory of God filled the whole place for about 18 months. Well, that's just a suggestion. I feel, I'm not saying this critically, dear brethren, for I'm involved in this. I am guilty as well. I feel that we are largely losing the conception of God. First of all, in our soul. And then, of course, we're losing it in our meeting. As well. But this great God has a relationship. He's the God of Jeshurun. In his titles, there are those personal titles. You know, Elohim, God, and Jehovah, or Yahweh, if you're supposed to be intelligent. Jehovah.
Those are not shared. Those are God's personal titles. Then there are those moral titles. God has called the merciful, and he's called the holy one. But then, very precious, there are those, not just the personal titles or the moral titles, there are those relational titles where God is called the God of Bethel, the God of Jerusalem, the God of Daniel, the God of Abraham, the God of David, the God of Elijah. That is, these were places where God revealed himself, and these were people with whom God had a special relationship. And here we have it in our passage, just right here. Moses says, listen, he says, there's none like unto the God of Jeshurun. Now, Jeshurun, in this passage, was a name for Israel. And Moses was encouraging these people. He said, I want you people to remember that God has taken on a special relationship with you. You never would think about speaking of the God of the Philistines. And you wouldn't talk about the God of the Moabites in that particular sense. Not Chemosh or something like that. But the God of Jeshurun. And Jeshurun means, we didn't have time to mention it the other night, it only occurs four times in the Old Testament. Jeshurun means the righteous people. And wherever you get God bringing a people close to himself, it will always be reflected in the purity of their lives and in the righteousness of their conduct. The God of Jeshurun is the God of the righteous people. Now, I better go very quickly because I'm going to go back on my promise if I don't move on. The first couplet, after that opening line, the first couplet in this seven-line stanza is before us now in verse 26. This God, he rides upon the heaven in thy help, and in his excellency on the sky. Well, isn't this a very precious thing? Moses said, this God, you've not only got his transcendence, but he said you've got his timeliness. And you say, how do you get that? What are you talking about? How do you get that out of these two clauses? He rideth upon the heavens in thine help, and in his excellency on the sky. How many times do you read in the Bible about God riding? Nobody got the first prize. You want to see the stuff I have in the pocket here? Nobody got the first prize in you. There is none like seven times. And God's seen as riding seven times in the Bible. You see, when people are in need, God can come across the sky just to meet their need at the point of extremity. I can tell you his horses move with lightning speed, and the wheels of his chariot, they travel. They never need to be oiled. They never need to be greased. They never clog up his chariot. I think, is it actually one of the great riding chapters, the chariot chapters of the Bible, is Psalm 68. I just cannot quote every detail. There are two references in that psalm to God riding, and I think it tells us about the middle of the psalm that the chariots of God are 20,000. 20,000. Or in a Hebrew idiom, it's just saying 2 times 10,000. 10,000 to a Hebrew mind was a mind-boggling 10,000 chariots. You remember in that beautiful song, it says about the bridegroom that he's the chiefest among 10,000. 10,000's taken to be a large, take as many as you like, he's greater than them all. 10,000 is just the biggest number in the mind of a Hebrew. When he says in Psalms, he says God's chariots are twice 10,000. Unbelievable. So that God can travel wherever he is needed, wherever his help is required, wherever his people cry, he rideth upon the heavens to thy help, and in his excellency upon the sky. If I recall, Psalm 68 tells us that very matter. It tells us about God riding upon the heavens, somewhere about verse 4 of that chapter. And then in the very next verse, do you know what it says? He
He's the God of the fatherless. And he's the judge of the widow. You say, what do you mean? What do you mean? Sure, if God's chariot is in the sky and he's keeping sovereign supervision over all the affairs of earth, he has far greater things to think about. No, as soon as the psalmist mentions God's chariot riding in the sky, the next verse he talks about the orphan. And he speaks about the widow. There's maybe a widow in this meeting tonight. There's maybe a sister has come to this meeting tonight and you need help. And you just hardly know where to turn. Don't you recall that interesting story in the life of Elisha? When he was in a city and the Syrians besieged the city and they were just about to take him. And Elisha's assistant became all perturbed. And Elisha, he said, Lord, open the eyes of the young man. And when the young man's eyes were opened, he could see chariots and horses all around that he had never noticed. My dear sister, in this meeting tonight, remember the God who fills the heavens and the God who sweeps the sky. He knows all about your loneliness. And he knows about your need. And you read Psalm 68 verse 4. Is God riding upon the chariot of the sky? And Psalm 68 verse 5, is God coming to help the widow? The two things are just put together. Moses, he says, I want to tell you people. He says, all the resources that you will need are to be found in God. Now, just before I leave this, I have to point this out. One of the difficulties which these people were just about to encounter was the chariots of Canaan. When they crossed over the Jordan, they weren't too long there until some of these sophisticated Gentiles came with the latest technology in these chariots. They hadn't seen the likes of these since they left Egypt, and the chariots were covered by the waters of the sea. But they were going to see them in Canaan. They were to be intimidated by them. Moses says, now look, he says, you people are going to see chariots. But he says, I don't want you to despair. Because he said there are chariots that are unseen. The unseen reserve of God as he rides upon the heaven to thy help. Now, we'll come to the next double section, the double line, verse number 27. The first two lines of verse 27. The eternal God is thy refuge. And underneath are the everlasting arms. Now here we are on a rather different. It's not God's transcendence. And it's not God's timeliness. Rushing to help the needy. But this is God's tenderness. Carry and cradle underneath are the everlasting arms, and the eternal God is thy refuge. Now, this has been so often used in such a precious text, and I don't want to take away any of the preciousness of it, but just to look at it in its context here for a minute or two. This is the only time in the Bible that we have the expression, the eternal God. There are three occurrences, as many of you know, of the everlasting God. But this is the only time it's the eternal God. Now, I may get into trouble here, but I'm inclined to think that Mr. Darby is very correct when he translates this expression, the God of old. The God of old. And if that is true, Moses in this particular verse is not speaking about God as ever existing. He has already covered that. But he's speaking about the God who throughout history has always been the refuge of his people. The God of old. He said, don't forget that the God who was a refuge to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, and before that again to Noah. He said he's the God of all. Noah's great to know, brethren and sisters. Maybe if I knew enough here, you could tell me about some of the older believers whose help was really valued, but they're not here now. Their memory is fragrant, but their presence is gone. And I have often heard the believers say, and I know exactly what they mean, you know, if we could only have some of the old men back, it'd be a great help to them. I feel like that at times when I hear some of these older giants and Christians being talked about. If we could have only some of those older folk back again, they would be a great strength and a great stay. Moses says, now look, he says, I'm just about to go. He said, you won't have me. I don't think, to talk about the generation gap. He was 120. I don't think there was another man, maybe much less than about 40 years younger. All the in-between ones had died in the wilderness. The most of them were about 60. The older one. Moses really was like a fossil now. By this stage. And he says, I'm about to go. And he said, when I die, he said, you people will be inclined to think that this old antique man, once he goes, our link with sacred history has been severed. No. He says, I'll be going, but he says, the God of olden time, he said, he will be just the same, and he's your refuge. Now, this word refuge, it's a very, very interesting word. In fact, it's the word that sometimes is translated about land, a den. Now, I wouldn't just like to say, translated a den here, but what does a lion use a den for? Place of retreat, a place of rest. In fact, it's the very word I think is Psalm 71. The psalmist says, be thou my strong habitation, whereunto I may continually resort. A place of resort. It's the very word that Moses uses in his poem in Psalm 90. He said, Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. As they move through the desert in their tents, and they move from place to place, and the shifting sands of the desert reminded them of the changing texture of life. How many dwelling places they had, who knows? But he says, Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. You know, it's great to know, brethren and sisters, that no matter what the circumstances of life might bring and be, we can find rest, retreat, residence, resort, refuge, and resort in the God of old. The God of old is thy refuge. And then he says, underneath are the everlasting arms. You know, indeed, this book of Deuteronomy begins. If you were to go back to read chapter 1, Moses, and he said, you have blessed them, and you have multiplied them. But he said, they have become so many. He says, I can't bear them. He says, I can't carry them. He said, it's beyond me. He said, I'm going to need some assistance. And he says, all their burden. You think about those three words in chapter 1. I'll not elaborate upon them now. All their burden and all their cumbrance and all their strife. He says, I can't bear them. That's the way he begins the book. The burdens of the people of God were too much for a man. Even a man like Moses. But you know, before he finishes the book, he says, too much for me. But he says, underneath are the everlasting arms of Jehovah. Those arms will never weary. Those arms will never weaken. In fact, he tells us here in chapter 4, maybe chapter 5 of this book, he said, when you were coming through the wilderness, he said, God just led you and he carried you as a father carries his son. Lovely, homely little illustration. The little fellow going along and he can't go any further and the father just lifts him and puts him up on his shoulder. You know, there are times, and I'm maybe going to speak a little bit now beyond my experience, but I'll say this. There are times, dear brethren and sisters, when God takes from us every prop. And we have nothing left but him. When I went out full time, as they talk about, there was an older brother came to me. He said, David, I want to give you, say a little thing to you. He said, this is a very difficult path that you've chosen. And he said, may God be with you. And he said, it's a spiritual man now with a long life history, soul history of God behind him. He said, I want to tell you that. He said, sometimes we think we're trusting God. But he says, when he begins to remove the props, we'll find we've hardly been trusting him at all. He says, he may take away friends from you. And he says, you depend on friends. And he says, he may take away your health from you. And he said, he may take away success from you. He said, I want to tell you, David, likely at some stage in your life, God will take away every prop and you'll be left with him only. Underneath the everlasting arms. It's great to know, brethren and sisters, that God will never let us down. He will never let us go. We began this chapter with the saints sitting at his feet and in his hand. We came down the chapter and some of the saints were between his shoulder. Actually, I'm not exactly sure what it means to be between the shoulder. What does that expression mean, between the shoulder? That's between my shoulders there. Yes? That's between my shoulder. When it says about dwelling between God's shoulder, does that mean being carried on his back or leaning upon his bosom? In fact, from a Hebrew background, it tells us in one of those passages away over in the book of Kings, it says the man drew the arrow, and when the arrow reached its target, it hit the boy between the arm. And then the next verse says, pierced him at his heart. So between the arms is the heart. I think between the shoulder is not the back, it's the bosom. You know, it's great to be in his hand. It's great to be resting on his bosom. The hand of security. The heartbeat of sympathy. And the everlasting arms of unwavering support. This is a very... Moses was giving these Christians comfort. Dear Christian friend, remember, and we can depend upon this same God. Isaiah takes it up. Chapter 40, Isaiah tells us, he says, your God shall come, and he will carry the lamb with his arm. He will carry the lambs in it. Oh, you say, but sure, young people can manage themselves. Sure, the young will manage. They have a bit of breeze, and they're bumptious, and energy, and health, and strength, and they can stand on their own feet, and they can travel. No, no. Even young believers need the power of God to keep them and preserve them. Carry the lambs in his arms. Isaiah 40. And then you just put beside that, as you have often done, Isaiah 46. He says, even down to old age, I will carry you. And he said, even though there should be hoary head, gray hair, even down to old age, my people shall prove my sovereign, eternal, omnipotent love. And when hoary hair shall their temples adore, like lambs they shall still in my bosom be born. Indeed, that very chapter, I'll try and conclude, that very chapter, Isaiah 46, it talks about idols. It's a funny chapter. If you ever let me come back, I'll speak on the humor of the Bible. The Bible is full of humor. Only some people don't know when to laugh. You know what God says in chapter 46? He says, when they were going out of Babylon, he says, they needed a whole range of carts to take the gods with them. And he says, they got the idols everywhere up the shelves, and they pulled the nails out of the boy's feet, so he had it toppled over, only they had him nailed down. But he says, they got the nails lifted, and they loaded all these idols into the cart. And they stacked the cart. And then he says, the wheels fell off the cart. And he says, they couldn't carry their gods. And the donkeys couldn't even pull their gods. They couldn't carry their gods. He says, that's idolatry. Well, it's idolatry. He says, it's the man carries the god. But he says, when it's me, I carry the man. He says, I can carry you all. You know, think how many are in those arms. Millions of saints across the world. Dear believers lying tonight in a hospital bed, and they don't have the strength even to take a drink of water. There they are safely. Brethren and sisters, we're absolutely secure. Underneath are the everlasting arms. Now, I should just finish. He shall thrust out the enemy before thee and shall say, destroy them. This is God's triumph. There will no enemy be able to withstand them. I'll not comment upon these two verses. That's the greatness, the uniqueness of Israel's God. Verse 28 and 29. It's the uniqueness of God's Israel. You see, when these people are blessed, verse 28 says they'll dwell in safety alone. That was the tragedy. God couldn't keep Israel from mixing up with the nation. Mixing up with them. But there's a day coming when Israel will have its place absolutely distinct. They'll dwell alone. Israel will be Israel's distinctiveness. Look at the next part of that verse, the two lines. The fountain or the offspring of Jacob shall be upon a land of corn and wine, and as heaven shall drop down dew. Not a lovely picture. The soil will give its corn and wine, and the sky will give its dew. The blessing of heaven and the blessing of earth. I could give that a spiritual application. Dew in the Bible is likened to the Holy Spirit. And corn and wine and the fruitfulness. The great delights of Israel in a coming day. Verse 29, it'll be a good verse to conclude on. Happy art thou, O Israel. Who is like unto thee, O people saved by the Lord? The shield of thy help, the sword of thine excellency. You know, they're doing their best, these dear folks, today, the land of Palestine, land of Israel. They're doing their best to get missile defense system. They'll not need any of these tracers in that coming day. Once Israel dwells alone, the heaven sends its dew, the earth yields its fruit. Israel will be happy, and God will be the shield of their defense and the sword of their excellency. He will keep away every missile, and even their enemies. Verse 28, anti-Semitism will be gone forever. Thine enemies shall be found liars unto thee. What does that mean? Thou shalt tread upon their high places. Look at how many places in the earth today a Jew would not be allowed to put his foot. Prohibited just because he is a Jew. He'd soon be given the freedom of the earth when the Jewish king has universal government. And the enemies will be found liar. Every one of those nations, I'm not going to mention them just now, every one of those nations that have sworn an oath that they will never stop and they will never rest until they have eliminated Israel. Every one of them will be seen to be liars. God's people in God's land, God's king in God's city, and the world basking in universal peace and under the righteous government of the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. Israel will be happy then. We can be happy now. We have these blessings in their spiritual form. Dear brethren and sisters, what a people. Thank God we're amongst them. What a God. I'm going to pray now. But you, dear Christians, put your hand on God. Keep going. You know, there was a man called Thomas Browning. He was a pastor in this very town, in Northampton, in the late 1600s. He was imprisoned for preaching the gospel in those difficult days in English history. I'm not just sure where he was in prison, but it was some distance from here. But he rode back to his flock. Days of persecution and pressure when some of the Christians were under pressure to move. And this is what Thomas Browning wrote back. He said, "My brethren, do not flee. There is no shadow like the shadow of God's wing. There is no protection like the safety of God's refuge. Therefore, keep close to God." I'm going away tonight. I may never be back here again. Thomas Browning's message hasn't changed. Dear brethren and sisters, don't be giving up. Don't be letting go. There's no place like God's assembly. There's no work like God's work. There's no book like God's book. There's no person like God's son. Keep going and keep close to God. And do not flee. May the God of Yeshua, may his blessing abundantly be amongst his people here. Shall we pray?